Welcome to Sunday Morning Poetry, where we will go over The Fountain by William Wordsworth. Now, if you remember, if you watched or listened to last week's episode on The Two April Mornings by William Wordsworth, The Fountain is a kind of follow-up, a compatriot. They go hand in hand. There are the Lucy poems with William Wordsworth. These would be called part of the Matthew poems about a conversation, and this poem is actually subtitled A Conversation. And it's a conversation with a young man. Imagine someone in, 20, 21 years old, with a much older man, 75, 80, 85. I believe in the two April mornings, Wordsworth says he's 72, or it might even be this one. We'll find out in a second. But, an older man and a younger man having a conversation. Now, one of the things I wanted to open with this time before we go into the poem is something that I touched on last time, and that is the idea of these characters that Wordsworth is interested in. And these are characters that are normally on the outskirts of our consciousness. We don't pay much attention to them. Another way of thinking about them is that they're on the outskirts of society. But really, I think for Wordsworth, who's focused on consciousness, what's relevant is how to you, if you're a young person particularly, that these older people are people you only interact with and think about and even try to empathize with and understand on a really minimal level. Now, one of the big shocking things about the lyrical ballads, which this poem comes from, it comes from the 1802 version of the lyrical ballads, which essentially launched the English Romantic movement. And one of the things that was very shocking to people were the focus by Wordsworth and Coleridge on all of these odd characters, convicts, mad mothers, drunkards, idiots, and the elderly. The people on the outskirts of society, and particularly not elites, but pastorals, shepherds, normal people, everyday language, who used everyday language, which is another critical part of the Romantic movement in English in particular, and with Wordsworth especially, who launched this in his advertisement to the 1798 lyrical ballads, and in his preface to the 1802 version, where he goes into a much longer version of an explanation, an essay on the nature of poetry and an expansion in what he thinks poetry can be. One of the things he's trying to do is make poetry, have poetical sentiments and reactions from the common language of men, but also coloring those everyday instances with imagination. And this is a big part of what is important, is you're out in pastures, you're out in nature, and you don't just copy what it feels like or something. You use an element of imagination. And for Wordsworth, this really meant a good amount of going into psychology. And I think Freud said the poets were there before me. He meant, I think people assume he meant specifically Oedipus, which he, did mean Sophocles and Oedipus and the ancient Greeks, which is true. They were interested in how man acted, which is essentially psychology, or, the causes of man's actions. And but poets have done this for thousands of years. It's not just Sophocles when Freud is mentioning this. And so my point is that, literature is the first place where psychology, the actions and thoughts of men, are really played out and, experimented with. And this is a good example of that. And The Fountain is a conversation, which is a good example of that as well, in terms of how we think about these people who are on the outskirts of our consciousness. So I just want to give you one example of how this is so shockingly odd, and how well done it happened, and why it was so odd, and it took people aback. Some people really liked it. Some people, had an above average hatred of it, and some people had an above average love of it. And that's how Wordsworth himself put it in the preface. So, to give you an example of how odd this is, I think it's helpful to take a survey of most of the television, movies, and even literature written today. And what you'll find is that you'll see a lot of psychology of victimhood, for instance, and particularly in literature and poetry, or in, you know, the more psychological depths you'll get in television and movies is you'll see Mad Men, for instance. That's a big one that is, or PTS, the broken soldier. So there's a lot of psychological elements that go into that. And just to give you a very recent example of the recording of this podcast is the new Ted Bundy movie with Zac Efron playing Ted Bundy, where essentially, I think it's shockingly, it's such a weird title, shockingly evil, wicked, and vile, or something like that, or extremely vile and wicked, or extremely wicked and vile. So shockingly evil, extremely wicked, and vile. I think that's the title. And it's a very odd movie in a lot of ways. It doesn't show any of the killings. I think there's one moment of violence, but there's always that subterfuge because we know what he did. And it's all about him lying to this woman who he claims to love. And the story is trying to get you to sympathize with him to some degree, even though he's an evil person. And we know it's in the title. So we know he's evil. We know he did all these things. You know, he's killed probably 100 women. But what the movie is doing is trying to go into the psychology of somebody who lies on, you know, who's lying so convincingly to so many people. And there's a scene at the end that I think is actually quite well done, acting and cinematography. Just the whole movement is very well done. And it's, you know, it's kind of a spoiler here, but you know what happens anyway in the story. It's essentially like he's found to be guilty, so you know that. But it's the scene with him and the girlfriend that he dated for years, where she confronts him. It's, you know, he's about to be executed. And there's this moment where she wants him to really admit it, to admit that he did these things, and he won't admit it. And then there's this back and forth between them. And then he writes something, finally, you know, breaks down. It's really, I think, well done. There's a lot of good acting in that. But my point is not, you know, an analysis of this movie, but rather the depths and the abilities that writers and creators have today to go into the psychological depths of a madman, of a psychopath, of a liar. But when we try to go, if we try to go into something like, I think a Steve Jobs or even a superhero, we don't really get an in-depth psychological look at what causes them to do those deeds. So my point is simply that, you know, if you watch any of these Avenger movies or Marvel or even just any hero movie, even like Daredevil, the conflict tends to be around, you know, the people in their lives that they're sacrificing for, but there's not a good view. And this, there is literature that has, you know, good views of the site. I think the Iliad does this, you know, the psychology of the hero and what makes them a hero, why they make those decisions. Essentially, we think, well, we can really understand this madman and the villain and the evil person really well. We can have all these videos and movies and books about this, and evil makes sense to us. Why people do these heroic good things, why people spend their whole lives to build a mega business to make money, but also to provide values for people, they just do it for money. But we wouldn't say the equivalent to that for killers. We wouldn't say, well, they just do it because it feels good. Although that may be part of it. There's something deeper going on with these killers. And so we should ask, well, what's deeper going on with the financial person who's, you know, like Ray Dalio, who's, you know, or Warren Buffett? There's got to be something psychologically going on, and it can't just be about money. I mean, Warren Buffett lives in like a dinky little house, and he's the richest man on the planet. It's like, wait, there's got to be something else a little bit deeper. You know, Steve Jobs didn't even really, and to some degree, enjoy a lot of his wealth because he worked all the time. What drove those people? We don't really have a good explanation, a good delving into these things, you know, psychologically. And, you know, again, I think the flip side is we do with these madmen. And so my point is that in Wordsworth's time, when he was going into these, you know, these people on the edges of our consciousness, the convict, the madman, that was radically new. And people questioned in general why we would want to learn anything from a convict, or in this case, from a retired schoolmaster who's, you know, very old. So there's a weird thing where people just weren't certain why they should learn anything from that. And it was just odd at that time. Now, of course, that's become more dominant for better and for worse. You know, there's nothing wrong with learning about Mad Men, by the way. I think there's something important about that. But that's a conversation for another time. So I just wanted to give you an idea of how radical, even though in our own time it's not very radical, it seems, you know, blasé. But in the time of William Wordsworth, it was very radical to be focused on these types of characters. Okay, so let's go into the poem. And before I leave this scene real quick, I just want to let you know, please go to troubadourmag.com. If you're watching, it's on the screen, TROUBADOURMAG.com. Sign up for the newsletter. I'll send occasional posts or a video once in a while, but most specifically, you're signing up to get the free magazine where, you know, I hand select the greatest romantic literature or something that teaches us about romanticism in some way of today and of the past. And that's kind of the goal of the Troubadour magazine. Is it's really about great literature in general, but I think romantic literature is the greatest. And, you know, we might put some other schools of thought there just to kind of contrast, or other schools of literature, like naturalism or something, just to give us some contrast. But the focus is always to understand and defend romanticism. And there's plenty of it to look at. Okay. So let's look at this poem, The Fountain. So as always, I'm going to read the poem. And then I'm going to go stanza by stanza, and we'll talk about it. The Fountain by William Wordsworth. We talked with open heart and tongue, affectionate and true, a pair of friends, though I was young, and Matthew 72. We lay beneath a spreading oak, beside a mossy seat, and from the turf a fountain broke and gurgled at our feet. "Now, Matthew," said I, "let us match this water's pleasant tune with some old border song, or catch that suits a summer's noon. Or of the church clock and the chimes, sing here beneath the shade that half-mad thing of witty rhymes which you last April made." In silence Matthew lay, and eyed the spring beneath the tree. And thus the dear old man replied, the gray-haired man of glee, "No check, no stay, this streamlet fears, how merrily it goes, 'twill murmur on 1,000 years, and flow as now it flows. And here on this delightful day, I cannot choose but think how oft, a vigorous man, I lay beside this fountain's brink. My eyes are dim with childish tears, my heart is idly stirred, for the same sound is in my ears which in those days I heard. Thus fares it still in our decay, and yet the wiser mind mourns less for what age takes away than what it leaves behind. The blackbird amid leafy trees, the lark above the hill, let loose their carols when they please, are quiet when they will. With nature never do they wage a foolish strife. They see a happy youth, and their old age is beautiful and free. But we are pressed by heavy laws, and often glad no more. We wear a face of joy, because we have been glad of yore. If there be one who need bemoan his kindred laid in earth, the household hearts that were his own, it is the man of mirth. My days, my friend, are almost gone. My life has been approved, and many love me, but by none am I enough beloved. Now both himself and me he wrongs, the man who thus complains. I live and sing my idle songs upon these happy plains. And Matthew, for thy children dead, I'll be a son to thee. At this he grasped my hand and said, alas, it cannot be. We rose up from the mountainside and down the smooth descent, of the green sheep track did we glide, and through the wood we went. And ere we came to Leonard's Rock, he sang those witty rhymes about the crazy old church clock and the bewildered chimes. Okay, well, I hope you enjoyed that. And I think there's not too many words that you don't know, of course, or at least that I didn't know. But it does always help to think about some of the words. If you're not getting a visualization, you might want to look it up just to, you know, get something. You know, when he talks about a fountain, he's not talking about, you know, one of those fountains with two cupids spitting into each other's mouth. Like, this is a natural spring that is gurgling at their feet and going into a river, like a little streamlet, he calls it later. Another word we're going to talk about later is actually a simple one that you know the definition to, but it's, you know, I personally always look at, if I don't quite understand a stanza for whatever reason, I start looking at each word more carefully and thinking about how a particular word that I think I know but seems important relates to the whole story. So there's one, and I'm trying to find it on the on this video here, but it's fair, F-A-R-E, which we'll get to when we which we'll talk about when we get there. And I think that's actually a very important, here it is: thus fares it still in our decay. And that, especially in this passage, which is the passage where he says the wiser mind mourns less for what age takes away than what it leaves behind, which I think is the essence of the theme summed up here. And so when I was reading this, just to give you an idea of my, you know, how I assess or approach a poem, this sentence didn't make any sense to me. Thus fares it still in our decay, which just was words. And so I had to break it down to think about it. And the word that stuck out to me, I mean, thus and it and still and in our decay, those individual words didn't really seem to be difficult to understand. Or I knew what they each meant individually. Fares, I knew what it meant, but for something about the way I thought about it, that word didn't make sense in this, you know, wasn't organizing, wasn't integrating the sentence into meaning for me. So when I looked it up, I got a better idea of it, refreshed my mind on the real meaning of the word, and it, you know, the meaning became very clear to me. So that's how I approach, you know, literature a lot of times. And I did not do that after first reading. I did it after like an eighth or ninth reading, you know, several times of reading and going through this. So that's how I approach literature, just so you have, you know, if you're ever curious. Okay, so let's go stanza by stanza. One thing I want to set this up with is, you know, we talked about this at the beginning and with the two April mornings, where Wordsworth and the Romantics in particular are famous for their interest in the ability of nature to teach us about life. But the thing that makes them unique, it makes this unique, is not just their love of nature per se, but it's their using of their imagination. And there's a lot that Coleridge and Wordsworth wrote about the imagination, what they mean by imagination, and why that's so important to them. It's not just, you know, what we think of is, you know, go play and use your imagination, young man, you know, which is like go out and, you know, use sticks and pretend you're knights, which is, you know, that, you know, fighting with sticks out in the, you know, with your friends or something. And that there is some, that is imagination, and there's something to that. But what they really mean by this is taking the concretes, the images, the visuals, the, you know, ways of life and the, you know, that a shepherd has, and taking that into all, like applying that to all humanity. And the idea that whatever separates all of us along, you know, from Wordsworth, who was hundreds of years ago, to me sitting in this chair talking to a webcam, which is something that Wordsworth could never have fathomed. And he is speaking to me. And that's what's so, you got to understand that about some of this classic poetry, is especially these Romantics, is they had a sense of that. Shakespeare had a sense of the kind of immortality of his words. And you get that as part of the underpinning of the words, is, and how odd it is that I'm sitting here with a microphone and a webcam and a laptop, and I'm streaming this, you know, to you know, five people that watch it or whatever, but wherever you are, whatever time, and who knows, maybe sometime in the future, more people will be interested in poetry and share this so more people can see it. But the point is that, you know, it's so odd that hundreds of years later, he's speaking some truth and some in conveying an emotion, this dead guy who, you know, emotions are about living, and yet he's somehow captured this emotion. And I would sum up the emotion as the emotion of loss, and, you know, Matthew lamenting the being bereft of his family because he's grown old. So let's go through this, and we'll learn a little bit more about the meaning of this poem. Try to think about, like, loss, memory of joy and pain, as well as, you know, the two April mornings was more specifically about how we deal with grief. This is similar, but there's going to be a little bit different. There's going to be some slight differences here. Okay. So let's go into this. So first off, we have, you know, this, you know, it's called a conversation. We have this opening stanza. We talked with open heart and tongue. And, you know, so this is, again, a real sign, even though that's a pretty simple image, but that's always a sign of a romantic, that they don't just say we had a conversation. Like, he says we talked with open heart and tongue. So he's using visuals. You can visualize a heart. You can visualize a tongue, right? Affectionate and true. And that's, you know, this is a synonym, another way of saying had a conversation. A pair of friends, though I was young, and Matthew 72. Now, this again with the Matthew poems is very important, the relationship between the two. And you try to take it seriously. So when you're 20 and you're talking to a 72-year-old, it's a different experience. I mean, you can experience this, as I mentioned last time, even when you're in your 30s and you're talking to a 20-year-old, where, you know, you're telling them some piece of advice that you know is true because you've had 10 years of experience dealing with this. So you've done it over and over and over and over again. You know it's true, and you're trying to convey it, and they're going to go make the same mistake anyway. And that's an important part of the frustration between these two people. And you're going to see at the end of this poem that the narrator, the young person, doesn't get what he's saying, what Matthew is trying to convey to him. Not really. So there is that relationship. And then on the flip side, there's the kind of shock of, you know, Matthew, who's enjoying his time, or excuse me, the young person, the narrator, Wordsworth, who's enjoying his time with this, you know, beautiful, spreading oak and a mossy seat, and there's a fountain that's gurgling at their feet. It's like, what a beautiful day it is. And then Matthew just goes, you know, into this really pensive, dark place. It's like, what the hell's wrong with you, man? Calm down. We're just enjoying the day. Just experience. But that's a big difference between, you know, a young person who has nothing to draw on from their past and an old person who has all of his life, and he's at the very end of his life. Okay, so we talked with open heart and tongue, and so it's the young and the old person. The next stanza is, we lay beneath a spreading oak beside a mossy seat, and from the turf a fountain broke and gurgled at our feet. So he is, Wordsworth here is drawing upon a long history from Roman times in particular to today of these pastoral stories. And this one in particular, there, if you read the Virgil's Eclogue 1, it's a pastoral between two shepherds, essentially. And if you read that, there's it's a conversation about being displaced at a time of turmoil in the area. And one shepherd is an outcast to his land after the assassination of Caesar, and the land is being given to the war veterans, the soldiers, who required it in payment for their deeds in fighting, right? And the other shepherd has been allowed to stay on his land. And the reason is he went to beg to quote-unquote a youth who is likely Augustus, the new ruler of Rome, to stay on his land, and, you know, this was granted to him. So there is something here again, you know, Wordsworth is drawing from Virgil and this particular eclogue with this poem now, or with this stanza. Now, I want to stress that I'm trying to add a little bit of detail for you. You do not need to know that. some books, like the book I have, made reference to the Eclogue. I went and read the Eclogue. So it's not like I knew that. It was just in the book that I read. But if you like read this and the book that I'm reading, by the way, is Wordsworth and Coleridge, Lyrical Ballads. It's a good one. It has the 1798 and 1802 version. It is the Oxford World's Classics. It's a good, very good, overview of all of it with all the great poems in there. My point is that if you don't know that about the Eclogues, that's okay. You don't need to know it. It's just I'm trying to add a little bit here for you. So anyway, in the fountain here, two men lay beneath this canopy or a spreading oak. You know, so think of like a cover, a bower. They're just kind of laying in the shade. And there's a fountain kind of gurgling near their feet. And just some pastoral images. And Wordsworth is just setting up this scene, essentially, of what's going on between Matthew and this young narrator. Now, the next stanza. "Now, Matthew," said I, "let us match this water's pleasant tune with some old border song, or catch that suits the summer's noon." So the narrator, who's young, of course, and happy and excited about the possibilities of life, he's all, you know, how great it is to be young. And he's giddy and young, and he's wishing to sing a ballad, a border song, and or to even sing the song. Well, that's in the next stanza. But, you know, he says in the next stanza, "that half-mad thing of witty rhymes which you last April made," which could be in reference to the two April mornings. So, but the point is that he wants to sing a song here, and he wants to be happy and giddy and just enjoy time. And then the next stanza, "or of the church clock and chimes, and sing here beneath the shade that half-mad thing of witty rhymes which you last April made." And then, the next stanza after that. "In silence, Matthew lay and eyed the spring beneath the tree." And thus the dear old man replied, the gray-haired man of glee. So as the narrator is all happy and giddy and saying, "sing the song, or let's go enjoy this day," pensive Matthew eyes the spring. You know, there's a pensiveness to him. There's a gloominess to him. He eyed the spring like it's almost like he's suspicious of it. Like you eye something like, what's going on over there? Is that thing going to attack us? What's going on? And he's the gray-haired man of glee. So he's a happy man, but he's a gray-haired happy man. So this is what happens after a lifetime of glee. "No check, no stay." This is a quote, or in the next stanza is a quote from Matthew. He says, "No check, no stay, this streamlet fears. How merrily it goes! 'Twill murmur on 1,000 years and flow as now it flows." So he kind of reflects on the destination of the stream, right? It merrily goes to, let's say, some vale or some, you know, river or something like that, where it will murmur in the same way then as it does today, unchanging for thousands of years. So this murmur, and you know, murmur is a good little word. You know, it's like the sounds you hear someone murmuring together, you know, over here, two people having a conversation, right? And it's going to have that little merrily murmuring for thousands of years. It's never going to change. It's going to be fun and enjoyable and do what it does forever. So that's part of like a recollection or an understanding of nature, that nature just is what it is. Okay, the next line. "And here on this delightful day, I cannot choose but think how oft a vigorous man I lay beside this fountain's brink." So Matthew here reflects how as a vigorous, or think about him as a younger man, he often laid, here beside this brink. So again, we get this idea that we got in two April mornings where this young person is kind of just enjoying the day. And then this old person is struck by a memory, right? He's struck by himself as a young man and how when he was vigorous and, you know, able to jump up on rocks and dance and sing, you know, full throated songs and be happy and all this energy, that he is, you know, 72 at the end of his life, remembering those of his own times. The next stanza. "My eyes are dim with childish tears. My heart is idly stirred. For the same sound is in my ears which in those days I heard. So this recollection of his own youth brings a tear to his eye, though he has changed greatly, the stream remains. The sound is in my ears, he says, for the same sound is in my ears. So nothing has changed in the world except him, or at least in the natural world. So this is a relationship between the unchanging natural world and himself. And so, you know, he's sad. It's a childish tear. He's sad about this, you know, idea, or there's at least a moment of profundity in his mind that his time is almost past and this stream isn't, right? The stream is going to keep on going forever and forever. And there is something that's different in some philosophies today that, you know, basically announces that there's really not much difference between us. Like when we die, oh, we become a tree and how beautiful. We're just, you know, that's just part of nature. And that's true. But here there is a much more reverence for the consciousness that the stream just does what it does. He gives some elements of consciousness or some words of consciousness to the stream, like murmurs. And that's what makes it beautiful, is that the murmuring goes on forever. Just like Matthew wishes he could murmur forever in a certain sense, or maybe he doesn't, but there is some view that perhaps it would be nice, or you know, he's saddened by this this revelation of the relationship between the changing and the unchanging. But he goes on. There's more to what makes him sad. That's not the only thing that makes him sad. That's the underlying thing. There's something else going on here. The next stanza. Thus fares it still in our decay. And yet the wiser mind, mourns less for what age takes away than what it leaves behind. Now let's talk about this first sentence before we move into the, I think, incredible quote. The wiser mind mourns less for what age takes away than what it leaves behind. I think that's an important quote. But fares, F-A-R-E-S, is an important word here, I believe. Not in the sense of paying like your cab, or if you're under the age of 9, your Uber fare, but rather in the sense of taking a fare from like San Francisco to Napa Valley, in the sense of a journey. Fare, the original meaning is traveling, a journey or expedition. The journey is one of life. This is the decay. Thus fares it still in our decay. So there's still in our decay, the fare is the decay, or the fare, the travel, is the travel of life into decay and death. We are born and journey by way of decay. Whereas this stream does not have that. It has a different journey. It journeys down the streamlet into this valley or into this, you know, lake. And it just, a river or whatever, and it just does that forever. It's constant, but not humans, not Matthew. Yet wiser minds do not mourn the loss that comes with age, but rather what it leaves behind. In other words, loss is inevitable. We all know that. The longer we live, I mean, the only way to avoid loss is to die young. So the longer we live, the more we're going to lose people. And just think of death in specific. People will die in your lives. That's, if you live a long time, that's just going to happen. Life. But the wiser mind doesn't mourn that as much as what is left behind. So think about this for a second. And there's a couple senses you can take this. So in other words, loss is inevitable, but the tragedy is that what is left behind, what remains with us, is this double sense of joy and grief. So in other words, we lose a loved one but once. We are left with the memory every moment, second, minute, day, year of the rest of our lives. So that's what I think he's saying here, is that we are left with the emotions. That's what's left behind when you lose somebody. But when you lose them, you only lose them once, which is why the wise man doesn't mourn the loss of what age takes away from us, takes from us. It takes a child, in, like in the two April mornings. But what the wiser mind mourns is what's left behind. It's the joy and also the grief that you remind. You know, you wake up and you have joy of that person that's no longer there. Okay, the next stanza. The blackbird amid leafy trees, the lark above the hill, let loose their carols when they please, are quiet when they will. So nature does not suffer in the way that he just mentioned. When a lark, you know, when they act a certain way and they cease when they act that way, you know, that's the circle of life is how we put it. There's no, you know, things die and they, you know, a bird moves on. It's not a big deal. And there's a freedom to it. Is they you know, chirp here if they want to. They stop if they want to. Nobody tells them what to do. It's just they do what they do. The next stanza. With nature, never do they wage a foolish strife. They see a happy youth, and their old age is beautiful and free. So, unlike what sometimes humans do, nature, or like let's say a bird in this case, never fights with reality. If a mate, if another bird for you know dies, if another bird dies, and the mate of the bird dies, the other bird is just the same as before the mate dies, and it's the same in youth as it is in old age. There's basically very little change. This is the circle of life. There's not this mourning process that they have to go through. But we are pressed by heavy laws, and often glad no more. We wear a face of joy because we've been glad of yore. So not men. He's stressing again, men don't have this ability. We are burdened with moral and societal laws and norms. We're supposed, you know, in the South, this isn't Gone with the Wind, you're supposed to wear mourning colors, mourning. The wife of a deceased husband is supposed to wear mourning covers for like 6 weeks I don't remember the time, but there's some allotted amount of time. So there's some period you're supposed to mourn. Like that's a societal laws. There's heavy laws of how we're supposed to act and moral laws of how we're supposed to act, which nature doesn't have. And even when we're not happy, we're supposed to pretend to be, you know, we're supposed to put on a happy face. Next stanza. If there be one who need bemoan his kindred laid in earth, the household hearts that were his own, it is the man of mirth. So kindred, brothers, sisters, family, mirth, happy, right? So, you know, we've kind of heard in the modern version of like the sad clown is one thing, and sometimes they're the saddest of people, or the people who you think are happy. And if there be one who need to bemoan his kindred laid in earth, the household hearts that were his own, it is the man of mirth. So the happy man is the man who needs most to express his sorrow, because a lot of times he doesn't let himself. Next stanza. My days, my friend, are almost gone. My life has been approved, and many love me, but by none am I enough beloved. So Matthew claims here he had led a good life, but that he was never beloved enough, which I think is an interesting sentiment. Because what is loved enough? How much love is enough? How many, you know, points do if every bit of love, if you were to be able to quantify it, is one point, how many points do you need to be considered beloved enough? And I think in our social media era, this is actually a very important thing to consider. You know, if you're on Instagram and you're sharing something of your day or yourself, how many hearts do you have to have? How much is enough? Is 10 good? What if it was 10 real, all of your 10 good friends? What about 100? What about 1,000,000? Right? And I think about that sometimes with the work that I do, where sometimes in social media marketing, people get obsessed with numbers. And one of the questions should always be, well, how much is enough? Like, at what point, like, do you just want more, any more? It doesn't matter what it is. Or what if we just had 10 good ones and we can make sales from those 10? And I think this is an important concept that is really hard to wrap your head around, that it's not just about, you know, quantity, it's about quality and who you're getting. You know, if you only have 1,000 people in your little network, but you're selling to all of them, that's a huge success in social media. So in anything, not just in social media. So, and when you think about, you know, when you put up a tweet of something you think about, you know, or you have an idea about some cultural event and you tweet something and you want people to share it, well, how much is enough? Do you need to, you know, if 2 people share it, is that good? Do you have to find, I mean, my point is to think about what is enough in this. Is like, is there a limit? Is there a desire you have? And I think it's helpful to kind of be satisfied with, you know, smaller numbers, but having a deeper impact. Okay. On those smaller numbers, I should say. Okay, next stanza. Now both himself and me he wrongs, the man who thus complains. I live and sing my idle songs upon these happy plains. So the narrator basically is claiming that Matthew is wrong to complain about these things, because here they are happy and singing. So the point, I think, of this stanza is that the youth does not understand at all any of the things that Matthew is showing him. That, you know, the idea that the wiser mind mourns less what age takes away than what is left behind. I don't think, because the narrator has lost nothing. So he has no concept of understanding that. Okay. And Matthew, for thy children dead, I'll be a son to thee. At this he grasped my hand and said, alas, that cannot be. So the narrator says that he will be a surrogate son to Matthew. But Matthew says, that cannot be. And what I think is going on here is the idea that a loss once endured cannot be undone. And even if, you know, I think people who are widows would understand this, that you can be remarried, but you can never replace that lost person. So there is something in that idea that you can have another child after losing a child, but you can never replace that, the loss and of that child. So this is kind of to the theme of lamenting the loss of, you know, what's left behind are those emotions that you're left with. Now the rest, I think, is kind of concluding in the way that the poem began, which is they're now, you know, back in just the pastoral images as they walk away from this emotional moment. And nature is kind of encompassing the structure of the whole poem. And you have these two people under this shaded area, and then these two people as they leave. I'm going to read both stanzas. We rose up from the fountain side and down the smooth descent of the green sheep track did we glide, and through the wood we went. And ere we came to Leonard's Rock, he sang those witty rhymes about the crazy old church clock and the bewildered chimes. So as they leave this little canopy, this bower, magical, imaginative land that was this canopy with this fountain gurgling, now that they've left the wood and through the wood we went, and before we came to Leonard's Rock, I don't know what that is exactly. I assume it's some special rock in England. He, Matthew, sang those witty rhymes about the... So now Matthew is in the singing mood. Now he's left his pensive area and he's back out there and he's going to sing about this old, this crazy old church clock, which is, you know, probably chiming at the wrong hour, right? So it's like this thing that's supposed to reflect reality, like the time of reality is off. It's wrong. And there's something I think important about that as well. And the, so in the bewildered chimes. And so Matthew is singing the songs that the narrator wanted him to sing at the beginning. Okay. So I hope you enjoyed the poem, The Fountain. I think it's, you know, it's worth going through several times and seeing what you get out of it. There's a lot going on with, you know, like I said, the structure where they start off And this is what's good about great poetry is there's purpose behind everything. So there's a meter that's going on here, and it's eliciting a certain emotion from you just by the sounds of the words. We talked with open heart and tongue, affectionate and true, a pair of friends, though I was young, and Matthew 72. And there's a kind of emotion of this. This is one of the things with poetry that I sometimes struggle with, understanding the emotions that the meter sometimes comes up with. There are explicitly understood and choreographed or you know, documented understandings of how the accents, you know, affect our mood and such, and what's a happy versus a melancholy tune and such. This, I think, is trying to be a little bit happier and upbeat in this moment. But then the language and what's actually happening is that it evokes something deeper. And then the structure of the poem is that, you know, they're starting under this spreading oak with this fountain, you know, just kind of this magical thing. And the thing out in the world impinges, infringes, breaks in on Matthew's consciousness and makes him remember something. And that is critical to this poem. And then, of course, they leave at the end of the poem. They leave this little bower, and then Matthew is back to the way he was. Okay, so I hope you enjoyed that. Please go to troubadourmag.com, sign up for the magazine. And also, if you're a writer, a poet, or a short story writer, go to troubadourmag.com, go to the more or submit now, and it'll take you down to the webs, the email address. Also read Clarion Call, which is on the homepage, to kind of get an idea of what we are looking for. So thank you so much for your time, and I'll see you next Sunday.